Well, you may not have heard of Matt Ridley yet, but millions of people have. In fact, he's the author of a series of books that shake things up on the subject of evolution, genetics, and society. And his new book will do just that. It will make you rethink both your interest in the future, the quality of our future, and how fast the future is coming to us. And that's a key thing because it's going to be here. The future's going to be here faster than you think. But the upside is it's going to be better than anybody's talking about yet, except for Matt Ridley next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Well, I haven't finished reading all of The Rational Optimist or How Prosperity Evolves from Matt Ridley, but I am going to finish this book because I'm very much interested in the future. And I resonated on every page with you, Matt, that I think we have a lot to look forward to. And all we have to do to understand that is to look into the past, wouldn't you say?
I would. And, a long time ago, back in 1830, a chap named Lord Macaulay said, "Why is it that with so much improvement behind us, we should expect only deterioration before us?" And that's kind of the way I feel, because there's been a lot of improvement since he said that. We're seeing huge changes in the way humans live and how their lives are being improved by the spread of the ability to work for each other, which is really what the modern world's all about. And I don't think that's going to stop anytime soon. In fact, I think it's accelerating because of the ability of the internet to put innovators in touch with each other and that sort of thing.
Well, I think too that part of what I like about your work here is you're fighting against a popular belief that our best years are behind us, and that it seems like this there's a what we would call a prevailing narrative that says that we peaked somewhere in the 1950s. We've been going downhill ever since then, and things will never get better. It'll just become a new variety of worse in the years ahead. But the statistics don't back that up.
That's right. I mean, I was born in the 1950s, and in my lifetime, the average citizen of the world has seen his income treble, and he's seen his lifespan increase by 30%. His probability of having to bury one of his children dropped by two-thirds, and the amount of food available to him has gone up by 30%, despite the fact that there are nearly three times as many people. And yet the population explosion, which happened in my lifetime, is slowing down. The rate of increase of world population has dropped by a half in my lifetime. These are the kinds of changes that are huge improvements in the lives, not just of Americans and Brits like me, but also Asians, and even starting in the last few years, Africans. We are seeing African poverty drop quite rapidly at the moment, for example.
And you mentioned that there are about six countries in the world that seem to be exempt from this overall growth. I mean, there are differences, obviously, between, say, the prosperity of South Korea and North Korea. But there really are just a handful of countries that have not that have been the one of the few boats in the harbor that didn't rise with the tide.
That's right. If you look at per capita income, in other words, how much each person earns, there are about six countries that are poorer now than they were in 1955. There are countries like Afghanistan and Sierra Leone and some of the other,
The Congo, right?
the Congo,
Somalia.
obviously, yeah.
Right.
Congo's way up there. Somalia, there are good reasons for this. They're usually called war.
Right.
And, there is undoubtedly depredations of people upon each other can indeed set back human living standards. And I'm not saying that it's a smooth upward path for everybody. In fact, you've only got to look at the history of your country and mine in the 20th century to know that you can have setbacks, you can have depressions, you can have wars, you can have droughts and famines and natural disasters and things that interrupt the improvement in people's lives. But if you pull back and look at the planet as a whole, and you look over a long enough period, you see that actually there's a remarkably smooth improvement in people's living standards. And just count things like, the availability of air conditioning or electric light or all these kind of things that we take for granted, which just were not were not affordable for a lot of people, even a generation ago.
Well, I think that, let's mention the air conditioning specifically, because isn't that interesting that there is a, you know, you were doing some of the flashbacks to the turn of the century versus today. Like, what do we have, like 78% of people that have air conditioning or something like that in the United States? Isn't that what it worked out to? And then, and then you go back just, you know, to, it wasn't that long ago when zero people had it. And now you have.
That's right.
Same thing with television, same thing with all sorts of electronic communications. The things that we have on our fingertips, we kind of take for granted, but the richest person in the world couldn't have afforded many of them not that long ago. And it wasn't that they didn't exist. It's just that, you know, they were cost prohibitive to have.
That's right. Or they hadn't been invented. Cornelius Vanderbilt didn't have air conditioning, for example. I mean, one of the statistics I like is that a person on welfare today is more likely to have air conditioning than a person on the average wage in the 1950s. But there's also some wonderful numbers which I was able to dig out from an economist named William Nordhaus about the price of artificial light. If you are on the average American wage today, and you want to read a book for an hour by the light of a compact fluorescent bulb, that electricity to light your book will cost you about half a second of work in your job. Mm. Back in the 1950s, with an incandescent light bulb and the then average wage, it would have cost you about 8 seconds. Now, that gives you 7.5 seconds to do something else in.
Yeah.
And if you go back to 1880, it cost 15 minutes of work. And well, back in 1800, you couldn't afford a candle at all, because only the richest had candles.
Only the richest people had candles. You had to do everything by firelight. You know, you mentioned this in terms of the cost of a cheeseburger, didn't you? What the how many minutes it would take for the average person to earn a hamburger? Wasn't it something
like that? That's right. Yeah, that's right. And the number of minutes you have to work to earn a hamburger, this is data from the Federal Reserve in Texas, has gone down dramatically over the last 50 years. That's the real measure, I think, that the amount of time you have to work to get something.
It used to be 30 minutes. It used to be 30 minutes, and now it's 3 minutes.
That's right, exactly.
Right.
It's gone down from 30 to 3. The number slipped my mind briefly there.
It's okay. No, I had to look it up while you were talking, but I excitedly found it, so I blurted. but I think that's so fascinating that we – and that's not just – I mean, we could look at the numbers and we could say – well, look, you know, look how much better we are. Look how much taller we are. Look how much cleaner the air is. Look how much cleaner the water is. I mean, from when I grew up, I don't know what the water was like for you in Britain, but in the United States, I lived near very polluted lakes that were catching, you know, and the rivers that were catching on fire. And it was that seemed to be our future. And then we cleaned it up, and now, you know, there's still problems. It's not perfect, but it's a lot better than it used to be.
That's right. I mean, I remember growing up in the 1970s, becoming an adult in the 1970s, it never occurred to me that pollution was going to get so much less. And you're right about water pollution. I live near a river called the Tyne, which runs through a big city, Newcastle upon Tyne, before it reaches the sea. And that estuary of the river was pretty well dead to life. Now it's one of the biggest runs of salmon in northern Europe that goes through that river. And the reason is because the sewage is no longer dumped straight into the river; it's treated and the river is clean. And there's huge variety of fish in the estuary of the river. You know, those kind of changes happen, and we kind of know they happen, but then we kind of forget about them and think, well, things are getting worse. But actually, a whole lot of things got better. I mean, there's the amount of radioactive fallout you and I encounter has gone way down, of course, since atmospheric testing stopped of nuclear weapons.
Well, talk about that. What does that mean in real terms?
Well, I mean, it's down something like 90%,
okay,
the amount of radioactivity that you and I encounter from nuclear weapons. I mean, there is a background level that hasn't changed.
Right.
But it's not doing any harm. Dioxins in birds' eggs in Sweden have been measured for a number of years, and they're down about 75%. Now, there are some things that are getting worse, obviously. You know, if you live in Beijing, I suspect the air quality has deteriorated. And, you know, you and I know that traffic congestion is a lot worse than it was when we were young,
sure.
et cetera.
Right.
I'm not saying everything gets better all the time, but I'm saying the big things, you know, things like child mortality, which after all
right.
is surely the biggest measure of misery you can think, dropping like a stone throughout the world.
Well, okay, but then we look at that, and yet you're up against this story that's being told and a sense of pessimism that says that we don't have anything to look forward to, or you might as well die young because we don't have a future. What do you imagine the future to be like? I mean, what do you think is coming? What is it that you see based on the story arc? And we look at these statistics. What are these statistics telling us about what there is to be rationally optimistic about?
Well, I sometimes admit to being, you know, I'm not being able to see the future very far, because after all, if you go back to 1900 and say what technologies are going to come along in the 20th century, you'd have done a poor job of predicting, you know, aircraft and cars and all these things, which let alone the cell phone or the search engine, you'd never have come up with them. And so there are bound to be things in this century that are going to take us by surprise, particularly in technology. But if you extrapolate forward, the rate of growth that's happened in my lifetime of people's per capita income, then the average citizen of the world will be 9 times as rich by 2100 as he is today. So that's, you know, imagine looking at your own salary and multiplying it by 9 times. And that means that you know, the average African will have the income of an average European today. Now, there are clearly, the other thing that's going to happen is that the population growth rate is falling and is going to hit zero around 2060 at current rates. That could change, but that's the way it looks at the moment. And that means that the impact of people on the planet can be actually reduced, because at the moment, crop yields are rising so steeply that we could feed 9 billion people from to a higher standard from less land than we are plowing to feed 6 billion at the moment. So I think we should be really raising our sights in the environmental way and saying, not let's stop things getting worse, but let's make things a lot better. Let's actually go for a reduction in the amount of land that we farm and an increase in the amount of wilderness. Let's start restoring environment all over the planet.
I love that. Now, let me go back to what you're talking about, say, the comparative economies of Africa versus, say, the European Union. In Europe, then that would imply that what the standard, if it's true what you said about that the average African will have the standard of living that the current average European has, what will life be like for the average European? I mean, what does that mean for them?
Well, we'll all be a lot better off. Now, people say, well, in that case, we're going to have more impact on the environment and we'll produce more carbon dioxide, et cetera. But if you look at carbon emissions for each amount of economic growth produced, they're actually falling too, because we're gradually switching to things like gas, which have less carbon in them than things like coal. And I suspect by mid-century, we'll be onto things like nuclear and perhaps solar as well in a bigger way. So I suspect you'll be able to have that sort of standard of living without using necessarily more resources. In many ways, we're getting more frugal in our use of resources. You know, a microchip has a lot less copper in it than it used to, and so on.
So, again, we're talking with Matt Ridley, the author of The Rational Optimist, How Prosperity Evolves. And it's about the future that we have in front of us and how much faster it's coming, which I think is also an interesting aspect to this story, that with every technological development, it gets the next one comes in half the time, that we're always having the times that of the ones that have come before us. And so things are really, you know, we're experiencing a lot of rapid growth and change. And we can look back, going all the way back to what, prehistoric times or caveman times or wherever it was when they, what was it like, the average planet inhabitant would have made the equivalent in today's terms of about $100 a year. And that figure didn't change for a very long time.
Yeah, I'm interested in going back even earlier to the point where it becomes meaningful to think about human prosperity at all, because often the word prosperity doesn't apply to a rabbit, does it? You know what I mean?
No. Right. Right.
And so what do we mean by that? And my answer is that that at a certain point we started working for each other. That's the secret of the modern economy, is that I do one specialized thing and you do one specialized thing. We all do. And we supply whatever it is we do to as many people as want it. And we do it through the market or, you know, or through government or whatever it is.
Right.
And everybody then can consume a diversity of things while only making one thing. And they only have to know about one thing in terms of producing it, but they can get to consume lots and lots of different things. And that's the measure of prosperity. So, for example, if you think of, I have this analogy in my book where you think about a rich man like Louis XIV, the King of France in 1700, who had 498 people to prepare his dinner every night. Well, actually, you and I have 498 people preparing our dinner tonight. They're in restaurants within an hour's drive of our house. None of them know they're preparing it for us, but what's the difference? They're standing ready at an hour's notice to serve us with whatever it is we decide to ask for off their menu. And so in that sense, we're all, the more we work for each other, the more prosperous we each become. Because self-sufficiency is poverty. I mean, if you had to wake up in the morning tomorrow and make your own clothing, your own food, your own shelter, and your own light and heat and all that sort of thing, then it would take you all day to achieve a very low standard of living.
It's
the more
pretty amazing.
You can actually acquire things from other people, the better off you'll be.
I'm going to read a little bit from the very beginning of The Rational Optimist. By the middle of this century, the human race will have expanded in 10,000 years from less than 10 million to nearly 10 billion people. Some of the billions alive today still live in misery and dearth, even worse than the worst experienced in the Stone Age. Some are worse off than they were just a few months or years before. But the vast majority of people are much better fed, much better sheltered, much better entertained, much better protected against disease, and much more likely to live to old age than their ancestors have ever been. And this is in a story arc that you measure over 10,000 years. And the real growth comes in the sometime in the mid 19th century. I mean, up until that point, the average per capita income would inch up, but it exploded in the last 150 years.
That's correct. And often, you know, income would go up before that, but the number of people would go up, and then you would get a slight diminution of living standards again because of too many people trying to eat the same amount of food or whatever. But around 1800, something pretty dramatic happens to per capita income measured around the world, according to the people who try and measure these things. And it obviously isn't easy to go back and get enough data, but their estimate is that real per capita income starts rocketing upwards around 1800. First of all, in one country, that's the UK, and then increasingly in other countries as well. And we call it the Industrial Revolution. And it was a revolution. Now, there's big disagreements about exactly why this happened, when and where it did, among historians. And I'm in a bit of a minority these days, in my view, which is that it's all about fossil fuels. That essentially, you know, what happened in around 1800 in Britain was that having relied on water mills and wood from forests to support our lifestyle, we began turning to coal. And coal turned out to be not a diminishing resource. In other words, the more you used of it, the more you found, at least,
right.
You know, eventually, of course, it runs out. But fossil fuels generally began to amplify the work that each of us did for the other. And so we got an increase in the productivity of people as resulting from that.
In our best times ever on the planet right now. And why do we think that this will end now? Well, we'll get into that coming up next with The Rational Optimist. Why would we think that things are just about to get worse? There's an answer for that, I think, and we'll explore that. Plus, we'll talk about the great salvation for all of us, according to Matt Ridley, is idea sex. When Ideas Have Sex. We'll talk about that next with the Rational Optimist on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. That's right. Idea sex changes everything about our future. The Rational Optimist explains that. And we'll talk about why the people that speak about our future the most think about it in terms that are counterintuitive to the evidence. The evidence says things are only getting better, and the rising tide will continue to raise all boats, except perhaps Afghanistan, Somalia, Congo, Sierra Leone, and a very isolated number of countries. And even there, it might get better. But why is irrational pessimism the arch enemy of the rational optimist? Next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. Matt Ridley, I should mention that I am a member of the Association of Professional Futurists, and I was singing the praises of your book recently at a convention, and I've been reading it with great interest because I do believe that we have a lot to look forward to and that our future is pretty good. I like many of the angles that you take toward this, and we'll talk more about turning point-itis. And idea sex, two concepts of the many that are in the book that I think we'll get to tonight on Coast to Coast. But let me ask you, why do you think the rational optimist is up against the irrational pessimist, and why the irrational pessimist is winning?
Well, this is something that still baffles me a bit. I don't quite understand why people on the whole feel the need to be pessimistic about the future, but I am very struck by how they do. I mean, not everybody is pessimistic about the future, obviously, and in fact, people are quite optimistic about their own lives looking a few years ahead. They tend to think they're going to stay married longer and earn more than they do, for example. But on the whole, if you read, you know, the intelligentsia on the subject of the future, they say there are terrible dangers ahead, whether it's climate change or war or Islamic terrorism or whatever it might be, that they foresee the bad and they tend to take for granted or forget about the good. It's partly that it just sounds wiser that way. I mean, somehow Pollyanna sounds just like a slightly silly person, whereas Cassandra, warning of a terrible future, she sounds wiser. So it's partly that, and it's partly a sort of an ingredient of nostalgia that people forget how much worse the past was because they kind of take for granted the improvements. You know, so you look at your cell phone and you get furious with it for failing to get an instant signal.
Right.
And, you know, your parents never got a mobile signal at all.
Right. And, you know, and I'll throw in an idea on why I think it's true, and you tell me whether you think could explain at least something. I've done a couple of rotations as a hospital chaplain intern, and I learned something in that I think that people, when they think about their lives, they don't want to think that things will be more fun after they're gone.
Yes, I think that's very interesting. Yeah, I mean, the older we get, of course, the more we look back on our childhood as a happy time, and we want to tell people how much better it was, and you didn't have to wait in line on the phone for booking a ticket or whatever it might be. So there's a tendency to want the next generation to appreciate just how much you've achieved in your generation or something like that.
You don't want to think that the party is just getting good when you have to go home. You don't want to.
Well, that's right. Yeah. I always wish I'd been born later than I did rather than earlier than I did. You've only got to think about the quality of dentistry in the 18th century, as P.J. O'Rourke once put it, to realize that the future is better than the past.
Yeah,
but, I mean, you and I are going to die before all sorts of exciting things happen. That's a shame. It would be nice to be there and see them.
So I think there's a natural psychological desire to think that we've peaked, And I think that this is something that's it's so attractive to us because it helps us in our mortality. That if we really focused on how good things were going to be, it would be we would be in a dither all the time. I mean, we would be taking every pill and jogging every mountain because we would think we can't possibly miss this. But it's so much easier to go, oh, it's just not going to be good. You know, this was it. This was as good as we ever had it. It was so much better 30 years ago. And that way it's easier to let go of it. And I think as a population group, the baby boomers are such a huge bubble, right? That they dominate the narrative. And I think because of their, especially because in the last 20 years, this has become, I think, much more of a prevailing thought about how bad the future is going to be. I think I think in a way it's dictated almost by the plurality of baby boomers that are out there. And maybe when the rest of us baby boomers die off, people in the generations behind us might be a little bit more optimistic than we are.
Right, right. And of course, one shouldn't forget we're in the middle of a bad recession now, and life has got worse for a lot of people in the last couple of years. And I'm not saying that your country or mine necessarily faces a golden, wonderful few years ahead. I think we may well face a decade or two of stagnation or economic bad times, as it were. But I'm looking at the perspective of the whole world, and the average Chinese is still seeing rises in his standard of living throughout this recession, for example. Another point is that people are a little superstitious, I think, about sounding too optimistic.
Yeah, it's true.
And my wife points out, because she's half Russian, that this is particularly true of Russians, that if you imagine the worst, maybe it won't happen.
Yeah, the worst you can be is disappointed you were wrong.
Yeah.
Right.
and I think that, way back in the time when we were creatures on the savannah, it didn't pay to look on the bright side of everything. So if a guy says, I shouldn't walk to the waterhole that way if I were you, I think there's a lion behind that rock, and you said, oh well, I suspect everything will turn out fine, and you wandered off down the track, then you know, the other guy lived and you didn't. So maybe natural selection selected pessimists.
That's true. And yet I would think that there's a difference between when we think about the word fear in the biblical sense of meaning respect, and fear, which often means we irrationally worry about things that can't actually happen or won't actually happen. I think that may be the dotted line between in a successful society, because I think especially in capitalism, I mean, you have to be optimistic. I mean, you have to think that there is a future to this. You can't just think, well, I'm just going to get mine now, screw everybody else. If everybody were doing that, the economy would fall apart.
Absolutely. And of course, at times in history, everybody has done that. You know, plunder has been the dominant way of life rather than exchange and specialization, which is what really works. And, you know, we do borrow in our lives against the future. We always have, actually. If you look at hunter-gatherers, the first 20 years of your life, you depend on other people to provide most of your calories. And the next 20 years of your life, you supply calories to a lot more people than just yourself. And it's the same with cash in your and my life. My kids don't expect to earn their living until they're 20 years old or so. But after that, they're going to start earning enough to be able to look after kids and maybe even relatives and elderly relatives and so on.
Like
and
us.
So we borrow against each other, you know, whichever is the most prosperous. And that requires a degree of optimism. You know, the whole capitalist system is a bit of a Ponzi scheme in the sense that you are borrowing because you think you'll be able to repay from a richer future. And on the whole, you can. But sometimes we overdo it a little bit, and that's very much, I think, what happened in the last few years, is that we borrowed a little more from the future than the future is going to be able to afford to repay, and we're having to work that out at the moment. But you're right, you can't borrow against the future unless you're optimistic that the future is going to be better. You know, the whole point of a mortgage is that you'll be able to pay it off, as it were.
The bank has to be optimistic that you're going to make that payment, and you have to be optimistic that it's worth doing. Because if you really didn't believe that there would be a future, get an apartment. You know, I mean, why carry a mortgage? Just get an apartment. The book is The Rational Optimist, How Prosperity Evolves. Let me ask you about idea sex. Talk to me about what that means, because you say this is part of what's going to save us in the future and has worked for us in the past is idea sex.
Well, this is my slightly facetious take on what makes the world work. I mean, you have to ask yourself, where does innovation come from? What causes people to come up with new ideas? And the answer is that they combine old ideas, usually. In other words, you bring together technologies and thoughts, and you put them together in new ways. And that way you're able to come up with new combinations of technologies, and it's very much a cumulative process. You know, a bicycle needs both steel and rubber and all these kind of inventions. And if you look at the same process in biology, sexual reproduction plays a huge part, because it means you can draw on mutations anywhere in a species and bring them together on the same team. Whereas if the species is not having sexual reproduction, then the mutations stay in separate lineages and compete against each other, if you see what I mean.
Yeah. And so
the role of exchange, of swapping ideas, plays the same role in our cultural explosion as the role of sex has been in biological evolution. That's my argument. And so it's a little facetious to call it sex between ideas, but I kind of really mean that. We even talk about it. We talk about the cross-fertilization of ideas, you know, when we're thinking of people influencing each other and coming up with combinations. And my point is really that we trundled along as a highly intelligent, imaginative species without doing this trick for a long time. And once we did it, it exploded. It sort of caused an enormous change, particularly in the last 45,000 years, from just an ordinary ape trundling around the savannah doing nothing very special to this extraordinary world-dominating position we're in today. So the secret of human history, if you like, in one sentence, is that ideas have sex. That's the way I put it.
No,
it's a provocative idea.
I think they have sex like fish have sex. You know, it's sort of, right? I mean, one fish lays down a bunch of eggs and another fish comes by and sprays a bunch of ideas on them, you know? I mean,
that's a very good point. Yeah, yes, I'm not really talking about, human sex is kind of different in a way.
Yeah. Right, and so it ends up being that it's sort of like idea sex is like fish sex, means then that it also gets carried into the current, and you never know where those ideas are going to go. The fertilized ideas are going to get carried off, and, you know, maybe some of them get gobbled up by, predators, but the surviving ideas that get out there, they stand a very interesting chance of developing into you know, even many more ideas.
That's a wonderful way of putting it. And if you think about it, you and I are sitting here, the beneficiaries of technologies that come from all over the world. I mean, you know, the numbers we use come from India, the alphabet comes from the ancient Phoenicians, the computer chips we're using come from Silicon Valley, the telephone was invented in New York State or whatever it was. I can't remember the details, but where the benefits of globalization are available to all of us. And that, of course, in the old days, it took a while. You know, the invention of paper or printing or gunpowder or whatever, the magnetic compass, you know, these come from China and they reach Europe after several hundred years. Now, if the Chinese invent a new software package or a new trick that enables us to improve search engines, we're going to find out about it within probably days or months or years. And Google's going to be acquiring the Chinese company or something and bringing the idea to all of us. And that's the sort of thing that's happening so much faster, thanks particularly to the internet, but even before that, thanks to globalization and the amount of trade going on. So I'm really, that's why I think the rate of innovation can only be speeding up. I don't believe it can be slowing down. Now, I should make one point, which intrigues me, which is that the rate of improvement in technologies isn't uniform. Some technologies change much faster than others. And if you think about transport for a moment, Our ancestors who lived in the 19th century saw much bigger improvements in the speed at which they could travel than we have seen. You know, they went from being limited by the speed of a horse to going at 80, 90 miles an hour in a train or pretty fast in a steamship within their lifetimes. We haven't really seen those kind of changes in speed. On the other hand, we've seen extraordinary changes in the speed and cheapness of communication.
Right.
That's been the one that's been revolutionized in our lifetime.
But in a way, that was... Yeah, I think those two are tied together, though, because so much of the need for that other speed was also built around communicating the mail, right, and communicating important data that there was no other way to transfer except using those methods.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, one of the one of the great benefits of the railway was that it was a communications technology. I think you're right. And then, of course, the telegraph comes along and so on. But you know, it's possible that our grandchildren will not see much change in the speed of communication, but they will see a big change in biotechnology or something. You know, so
right.
So some technology is going to advance faster than others. Nonetheless, the rate of innovation, and a lot of innovation is very mundane and even low tech. You know, the biggest impact, I reckon, on the 20th century may well not be computers, but container shipping or something like that. You know, these are Walmart's cross-decking, so it can make food cheaper in stores. You know, these are kind of things that we don't think of as high tech, but they are innovations, and those are going to be happening at a greater rate than ever.
Well, but then one also, I think you have to look at that and say, we had the SST, right? We had supersonic transport, but
correct.
We didn't really need it.
You know, that's right.
It just it was an appendix. It was a prehensile tail. It was whatever. We just didn't really need it. And
that's right.
And
the big transport breakthrough of our times was not supersonic transport, but was budget airlines.
Yeah,
same speed but lower cost.
Right, and I think that's what we needed, and that's why it expanded. If we really needed supersonic transport. You know, if it was really important to get to France really fast for so many Americans, we still have it.
It's all about price, isn't it? I mean, if it was cheaper, then if they could have made supersonic transport a lot cheaper, then I suspect it would have had a bigger market. But it turned out that for various reasons to do with physics, it was never going to be that cheap to fly planes at the speed of Concorde.
But I think there's also something to... if we're going to keep exploring this idea about idea sex, is that the need for technologies, to me, sometimes doesn't match the technological growth often. So we have more stuff than we may have need for. I think the iPad is a good example of that. I have an iPhone and I have a MacBook. I love them both. I don't really need an iPad. I think a lot of people who are buying an iPad buy it for the gee whiz factor because they're affluent enough to be able to just buy something that's kind of a fun toy that is really fits a very small, you know, sort of niche in people's overall needs. But that having been said, I think the iPad may end up creating something because so many people are going to have it that will eventually have an actual need for the iPad that doesn't exist right now, but will develop it.
Yes. What's so clever about the iPhone, at least, is the way in which through the open source ability to add apps to it, people make it ever more need satisfying, if you like, and so it
right.
sort of creates its own satisfaction for needs.
Yeah, ever more specific.
I think a lot of things go though from being something that only the most sort of technophilic people have to being something that we all feel we need. I mean, when the first cell phones came along, people said, "Well, you know, that's for people working on oil rigs or something."
Right.
And then it turned out we all wanted one.
It's funny. You probably never saw, there was an American show called Mannix. It was a private detective. And his gimmick was that he had a car phone. This was 1975, 74. That was his gimmick, that he was mobile, that he had a car phone, and he could pick up his phone. He could call at any time. He could call his secretary, and she would be able to tell him the latest things that were happening because he had a car phone. And, of course, you look at the car phone that he had back then, and it looked like a battlefield walkie-talkie by today's standard. Right? It looked like Alexander Graham Bell's car phone. And it's just so funny that today, it's almost laughable. You can't even watch the reruns without bursting out laughing. What would have been the most dramatic moment when he was picking up his car phone just seems ludicrous. It just seems like he should have a 100-foot cord coming out of the back of his convertible. All right, so we pick it up there. Now, we mentioned idea sex. You know what that is now, according to the rational optimist. What about turning point-itis? When do we face turning point-itis next on the future on Coast to Coast? This is Ian Punnett.